Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you our speaker for today. Des Smith is a graduate from the University of Tasmania in History and Law, and he's now the Senior Minister of the Christian Reformed Church in Kingston. It also so happens that Des is the godfather of my oldest son, Xavier, and in May this year became a father to Daniel Rory Charlton Smith. We've asked Des to address the topic today, the fundamental philosophical issue of the origin of evil. And so, Des, please come up.
Sure.
And I'd like to pray for you in just a moment, but Daniel Rory Charlton Smith.
It is a mouthful. I recognise that. We have condemned him to a lifetime of spending lots of time filling out forms. It's going to take him forever.
Let me pray for you, and then the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this occasion to think hard about difficult things. We ask that Des would speak to us clearly, and we ask that we would hear him well. We're sorry that sometimes we ask these kinds of questions without being willing to receive the answers that you give us. And so we pray that you help us to accept the truth wherever it might take us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Great. Well, look, thank you very much, Mikey, for your welcome today. And thank you very much for having me here today as well. It's really nice to be back at the University of Tasmania, albeit I spent most of my time in the law school and evidently, obviously, also the great rival of this esteemed establishment, the engineering school. But, you know, I gather the engineering faculty always put on better kegs than us, so who am I really to complain? As Mikey said, my name's Des Smith. I am the minister of one of the local churches down here. I'm here today to speak to you about the philosophical question of the problem of evil. Now, before I do that and before we really get stuck into it, let me just add three caveats to what I'm about to say. The first thing is simply to make a frank admission. I am not a philosopher. I was a lawyer in a previous life, and now I'm a Christian minister. Now, I'm not saying that as a cop-out. Anyone who decides to poke their heads over the parapets of a public discourse deserves to get shot down, regardless of their background. It's more just a way of making a frank admission. Philosophy is not my background, but it is an interest. Secondly, I want to be clear that there are lots of things that I won't actually be addressing today. For instance, I won't be addressing the existential issues of evil. What it means to live through suffering. What motivates religious people to do great acts of evil. Or what exactly God is doing about evil in the world. However, I would commend to you the other talks and seminars that are being held over this week to address those very issues. And thirdly, I will only be able to give a broad overview of the terrain today in this question of the origin or the problem of evil. I'm looking for broad today, not deep. I'm very happy to talk with you more about what little I know about the issue afterwards. I may have 41 minutes of material in me and not just 40, but today we're simply looking at the broad overview of this very important question. But with all of those caveats aside, and before this address already dies the death of 1,000 qualifications, let me tell you that this is a wonderful thing for you to be doing today. And I really do hope that you'll be able to come away from today with a better idea, a better understanding of the biblical perspective on this most important of human issues. Where did evil come from? What is the origin of evil? Which really brings me to my first point. It is really by way of introduction or second introduction. And that is to, in some way, define what exactly is the problem of evil. Of course, before we can define exactly what the problem of evil is, we must first have some kind of a crack at defining what evil is. Now, this in itself is a series of any number of addresses just simply on that question. For the sake of brevity, I'll simply use a common sense definition of the term, which is simply to say that evil is something that is which we feel ought not to be. That is, evil is a real part of lived experience which we feel shouldn't actually be a part of that experience. It is, to be slightly more concise, unjustifiable reality. Now, of course, that is a fairly broad definition, and yet I think it's a helpful one to encompass the scope of our lived experience as people, and that evil is something which is not just the most serious of events in our world, but something that touches each of us to some extent, possibly even every day of our lives. Evil is unjustifiable reality. But that then leads us to the question of the origin of evil. Where did it come from? And that is quite clearly a problem for Christian people. Christians believe, amongst other things about God, as Mikey has already said, that God is all good and all powerful. Now, Christians also believe that God created the universe. And so, we might reasonably expect that a universe created by an all-powerful, all-good God would be similarly flawless in itself. And yet, that's not how we experience the universe, is it? That's the very reason we're here. The universe doesn't seem to be flawless. Far from it. It seems to contain evil, which gives rise to two problems. The first is the rather narrower question of what is the origin of this evil? In other words, how did the evil manage to sneak in to the otherwise good universe? Where did it come from? In other words, it raises a question about the nature of evil itself. But secondly, and I think ultimately far more importantly, it raises a question not just about evil, but raises a question about God. Because the presence of evil in the world actually makes us a question about how, if evil is here, did it get here, and what does it say about the God who made the universe in which that evil has now crept in? Perhaps if I can use it by way of an illustration, imagine you've been invited to a spectacular dinner party. Your host has been talking up how absolutely flawless and perfect this party will be. And you walk in, and everything seems to be exactly like that. The tables are immaculately dressed, the food sumptuous, the guests stylish, the clothes sartorial. You sit down and begin your feast, until suddenly, a dirty great rat runs across your table, over your plate of foie gras, and into the punch. Now, of course, this raises the question, well, where on earth did the rat come from? But the next question is not too far off, is it? How did my host let the rat get in? Particularly when my host had promised me a flawless time. You see, the origin of evil leads inexorably, I think, to the much deeper and more fundamental question of the problem of evil. How does the host of this universe, God, allow the rat into our lives? Which then brings us then to really the meat of our discussion today, the problem of evil in a God-made world. Mikey has already to some extent summarised it, but let me do it again simply for the sake of clarification. The problem of evil can be quite simply stated by just making three points. The first point is that evil exists. The second proposition is that God is all-powerful. And the third proposition is that God is all-good. And therein lies the problem between trying to relate these three seemingly true propositions to one another. If God is all-powerful, he could make a world without evil. And if God is all-good, surely he would want to make a world without evil. And yet the first premise still seems to hold true. Evil exists. And therefore God is either not all-powerful or not all-good, or he's neither. That is the big problem of Christian theism. In fact, the German playwright George Buchner called it famously the rock of atheism. And to be fair, it's a problem that not only atheists have drawn attention to. Christians, and in fact theists generally, are painfully aware of the problem that evil in this world creates. They openly recognise it. In fact, even in the Christian and the Jewish Bible, we see painful examples of this. Let me give you just one example. In the Old Testament, there is the record of an 8th century Hebrew prophet, a man Habakkuk. He's an inhabitant of what we would now call the nation of Israel, and yet not as we currently know it. At the time of writing, that country is under the control of a foreign superpower, its neighbour Assyria. Understandably, being controlled by a foreign superpower brings a good deal of suffering into the lives of the Israelites and into his life. And this book is really a complaint to God about precisely that. A quick survey of the book, and it's only 3 chapters, quickly reveals that these 3 premises that we've gone through, evil exists, God is all-powerful, God is all-loving, all coexist together. So, for instance, he can say about the existence of evil in relation to the Assyrian conquest, destruction and violence are before me, there is strife and conflict abounds. And yet at the same time he can affirm that God is still all-powerful. When he refers to their eventual liberation by another superpower, Babylon, he can say of God, O Lord, are you not from everlasting? O Lord, you have appointed them, the Babylonians, to execute judgment. O rock, you have ordained them to punish. God is in control. And yet not only does evil exist and God is in control, but God is all good. He can say of the divine essence, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Habakkuk can hold perfectly consistently to all 3 propositions. The problem is, he just can't work out how they fit together. The opening line is in fact a cry of frustration at this very fact. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Now, it's not just atheists or non-theists of any description, agnostics, who've pointed out to Christians or other theists the problem of evil. No, theists have always been painfully aware of this. It's even in the Bible. Now, of course, Habakkuk and us, we could simply solve the problem quite easily. We could simply work out a way of denying one or more of the 3 premises, i.e. we could say that evil doesn't actually exist, or that God is in fact not all-powerful, or that God is in fact not all-good. We could do that, but not if we were to maintain some consistency to the biblical testimony, and as I hope we'll see, to the testimony of experience. Now, if we're constrained by them, we will need to hold all 3 propositions together. And the question for us is, can we actually do it? To put it more cheekily, can we do better than our friend Habakkuk? That's really what the rest of this presentation will be about today. And our plan of attack is pretty straightforward. We'll look at 3 historical attempts by people in the broad Christian tradition to answer the question, to reconcile these 3 propositions, and look at the good and bad points of each before settling down to our final conclusions. So, now, into the meat of our main dish, hopefully underspoiled by a passing rat. The first proposed solution is simply this, and it's the solution by what we might call universal order. It's not immediately apparent why it's called that, but I hope by the end of this point it will be. The first strategy of reconciling these 2 things addresses that first premise that we were discussing, the fact that evil exists, and it does so by a very neat trick. It's a neat trick in that it argues that evil does not really exist at all, or at least not in the sense that we think of existence. Now, how does it do that? Well, the way it does it is that it defines evil as negation. It defines evil not as something that is, but as everything that is not. So let me give you an example, a commonly used one in these areas. Cold doesn't exist in itself. Cold is merely the physical absence of heat. Likewise, darkness doesn't exist in itself. It is merely the absence of light. And so, say the proponents of this view, it's the same with evil. Evil doesn't exist. Evil is merely the absence or the negation of good. Now, you can immediately see the attraction of that argument for those who believe in the goodness of both God and creation. If you believe in a world which was created all good, It's very difficult to reconcile that with the idea that some actual things in that world are evil. But if you believe that evil is not a thing, then there's been in fact no incursion. Evil doesn't actually exist. And more than that, the all-powerful, all-good God has not created anything to incur into this creation. And hence he's not responsible for it. Rather, evil is merely the absence of good things. Now that is, of course, as we've already pointed out, something of a neat argument. But what does evil as negation actually look like in practice? It all works rather neatly on a philosopher's blackboard, but what does it look like in practice? Well, one Christian philosopher and theologian of the 4th century, Augustine of Hippo in North Africa, had a good hard crack at defining exactly what evil as nothingness actually looks like. And he did so by reference to the concept of disorderliness. For Augustine, goodness was in many ways not a thing, like a chair is a thing, or a mouse is a thing, or a plate of dinner is a thing. No, goodness is rather the order in which other things are arranged. Things can be ordered in a particular way which is pleasing to God, and they are by definition good. Therefore, evil is when those good things, or rather those things in the good order, become disordered. Let me give you an example again from this ill-fated dinner party. Ice cream is good. Bacon is good. Bacon is very good. Tomato sauce is good. But tomato sauce and bacon-flavoured ice cream is decidedly not good. Although I'm sure it will feature on MasterChef shortly. Probably twice baked and in three ways. You see the point there. All of these things are good. When I look upon the table, there's nothing bad for me to choose. But I can render them bad by disordering them, so to speak. That is Augustine's view of what makes something evil. But he also went, particularly later on in his career, to refine in a very helpful way what evil as negation means. Augustine went on to say that evil is not merely the objective disordering of things, ice cream and bacon and tomato sauce, but also the subjective disordering of things. He would talk about not only disordered things, but disordered loves. Things which are good in themselves, but which are loved too much. That the person who really loves ice cream, a good thing in itself, may in fact become obsessive about it. Or obsessive about things much less banal than that. Obsessive about the use of force, the assertion of the will to power, the obsession with sex, all good things in themselves, but when subjected to a degree of obsession, become evil. Evil is both the objective disordering of God's good order, but the subjective disordering of ill-attached loves. So, that's what evil as negation, according to our friend Augustine, looks like. So far, so good. God seems so far to be off the hook. Because evil doesn't yet technically exist, God cannot be said to have made it, thus protecting both his infinite power and goodness. But that doesn't let God off the hook quite yet, and Augustine knows it full well, because it raises a question. Because couldn't God have made a world in which the distortion of these good things he were made not possible? Could he not simply invent a world in which such disorder is impossible, where the negation of order is simply not something that can happen? Now, according to some later developers of this argument, because Augustine provided no answer to that, the answer is simply no. And this is significant for the steps that we'll take. These thinkers said, in fact, the existence of evil is not only something that happens to happen, but is in fact absolutely necessary. It's necessary in a finite universe. Now, why is that the case? Well, we need to flash forward to the 11th century theologian and philosopher Thomas Aquinas. And his view, quite similar to Augustine's, also saw evil as negation. He described the inevitability of evil as the result of what he called the bite of non-being. He said that created being is by definition good. But since the world is finite, it is not full of as much being as it might be. And as a result, there is necessary some non-being out there. Now, to us in our highly concrete 21st century world, we wonder what on earth Thomas Aquinas was smoking. And yet for him and his compatriots, and yet I think for us as we think in more deeply, this is actually not a bad point. How can, and so therefore, it doesn't have as much being as it might, and so evil as the negation of being is in some ways simply inevitable. Disorder will just naturally creep into the order of things in a finite world. And therefore, evil in fact finds a place of sorts in the universal order of the world. That's why this overall strategy is called the solution from universal order. It eventually finds a place, a location for evil in a finite world as the inevitable result of its finiteness. Now Leibniz, the 17th century mathematician, philosopher, theologian, co-inventor of calculus, founder in many ways therefore of this engineering school, took this then to its logical extreme. He said that not only is this world necessarily entailed in evil, that this world is in fact the best of all possible worlds, that God, making a finite world, could not have made it better than it currently is. That is the solution from universal order. Well, where does that leave us with solution one? Are we all done and dusted? Well, if we were to look at some of the strengths of this position, I think we might say, well, yes, we are, because there are admitted strengths here. One of the most useful ways that this argument gets us is it gets rid, pardon me, of the idea or any idea of evil as a thing in itself, of a substance. Now, that might seem unusual to us as modern ears, but when Augustine was writing, that was the current view. Evil was a substance, like chairs or rats or plates of dinner. It gets rid of that, and so therefore is able to preserve the fundamental goodness of the world and hence the goodness of God who made it. Indeed, also, that idea of evil as negation, of privative, of the absence of the good, does actually have a certain phenomenological ring to it. It is, in fact, how we often experience evil. Isn't it so often the case when you think of some heinous crime or event? Isn't it often simply a good thing taken too far? So rape is the result of lust. But lust ultimately has its origin in a good thing, the human desire for sexual intimacy with people. Or violence, even leading to murder, is the use of a good thing, strength, but simply for disordered purposes. If you're asked to point to something that is in itself purely evil, you'll struggle, I wager. All you can point to is good things gone bad. So there's something incredibly valuable about this view of evil as privation. But it also does have significant, and I think possibly fatal, weaknesses. The first is simply this, that yes, although we can conceive of evil as the negation of reality, it does seem a somewhat anemic description of it, doesn't it? Yes, evil may be nothing, but gosh, it feels like something, doesn't it? This was precisely the point that the atheist author Voltaire wrote precisely against Leibniz. In fact, he pilloried in his book this phrase, "This is the best of all possible worlds," and used as fuel for the fire the terrible earthquake in Lisbon in 1755, which killed upwards of 100,000 people. "Oh yes," says Voltaire to Leibniz, "this is the best of all possible worlds. This is the best your God can do." I simply don't buy it. "Oh, evil's nothing, is it? Well, tell 100,000 families that." No, it just doesn't seem strong enough. But there's also a more subtle problem with this conception of evil. Because in finding a place for evil in the created order, even as the shadow of being, it actually tends to rationalise it. It finds in the good creation a proper place for evil. And in rationalising it, it necessarily tends, therefore, to excuse it, No, evil really isn't as evil as you think. It's just the necessary part of living in a finite world. It begins to make evil necessary. And that is something that we generally find repulsive when we really think of the most awful human tragedies, because that's precisely how they don't seem to us necessary. They seem completely the opposite. And the Bible comports with our natural feelings. The Bible always describes evil as something which has its own reality, in a sense, and always rejects the necessity of evil. Another Old Testament Hebrew prophet writing in the same time, Isaiah, can say these words: "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Now, good and evil are never just two sides of the same coin for the Bible. They are never ultimately connected. We will never get, in the words of Nietzsche, beyond good and evil. They are separate, all the way down. So, let's then move on to our next proposition, or our next proposed solution, and see if it fares any better. Well, the second proposed solution to the problem of evil, as we've stated it, actually takes an entirely different approach. This is the approach from autonomous freedom. Whereas the first strategy addressed the first premise, the existence of evil, this second premise quite happily concedes that evil does in fact exist, does have a sense of its own beingness. Rather, it addresses the second premise, the all-powerfulness of God. And I think once I've described it, it will be far more familiar to you than the one we've just looked at. Where the first solution effectively denies the existence of evil, this takes the opposite tack and affirms its existence, but simply denies that God caused it and is hence responsible for it. Where the first solution stressed the continuity of evil with the created order, this stresses its radical discontinuity. But that leads us to the question: if evil exists, but God is not responsible for it, he didn't let the rat into the restaurant, who is? Well, the answer, according to this, is us. And more particularly, our freedom, or our autonomous freedom, as the proposition calls it. Well, how is human freedom responsible for evil? Well, I'm sure it's an answer that, even if you've never heard it before, makes an awful lot of sense. Evil is possible because if we are truly to be free, there must be the possibility of us choosing the wrong thing. This is the common conception of freedom, which philosophers refer to as contra-causal freedom. The idea that for an agent to be truly autonomous, truly free, when presented with A or B, they must be genuinely free to choose either in an unpredictable fashion. Kant was very strong on this. He, in fact, said that freedom necessarily involved the possibility of choosing evil. The Danish philosopher and theologian Kierkegaard would go on to refine this idea in an important way. He went on to say that, well, no, freedom doesn't necessarily involve the possibility of choosing evil. He made the very good point that pre-fall, in an unfallen world, there was literally no evil to choose. Adam and Eve, and let's not get into the question of whether they're fictional or representative or actual people, Adam and Eve, when they woke up in the morning and thought, what evil can I choose, were fairly limited in options. They simply weren't there. No, they were perfectly free, but they had no evil from which to choose. And hence, freedom does not necessarily entail the freedom to do the wrong thing. The point that Kierkegaard made, and it's very important to understand, is that rather than that, the freedom gave rise to at least the possibility of anxiety, what he referred to as the vertigo of freedom. Adam and Eve wake up one morning and think, what shall we do today? Oh, I don't know. Anything. It's a little bit like the equivalent of, can you imagine, you know, whenever you walk into an ice cream bar, when I used to walk into an ice cream bar as a kid, there was a selection of three flavours. There was chocolate, there was vanilla, and there was strawberry. Now I walk into an ice cream bar, and there's more varieties of ice cream than I've ever heard of before. But the problem is, far from being a freeing experience, the fact that I can have pistachio or tomato sauce and bacon or whatever, far from liberating me, seems to only paralyse me. And in fact, when I choose the one, it only makes me feel the absence of the other 34 all the more keenly. I feel in some very small way the concept of dread, the concept of angst, the concept of anxiety. That is the title of Kierkegaard's most popular book. The panic, the vertigo of freedom. And so he posits, human beings faced with this, faced with the anxiety of utter freedom, simply panic and disorder the world for no particular reason. But it does still involve a real possibility of evil. That's what freedom necessarily entails. But that then raises another question. Why did God actually create people with freedom then? If he knew that freedom was going to be such a risky business, if he knew that there was every chance that they would in fact choose the tomato and bacon-flavoured ice cream, why did he go to all the bother? Wouldn't his good universe have been much safer in the hands of robots? Well, of course, I think we all intuitively know the answer to that. We all intuitively feel, and the Bible certainly assures us, that God wants more than simply robots. He wants more than simply service machines. He wants to make fully morally responsible beings who can freely respond to him in love. And he could only do so if they were genuinely free to choose not for him, but against him. And therefore, granting human beings freedom was worth the risk. Well, what are we to make of this particular formulation of the problem of evil? Well, again, it's got strengths. It steadfastly refuses to make evil inevitable or necessary in the way that the first one did. Yes, evil may well be the necessary byproduct of freedom, but it's still radically other to the created world. That's quite a different conception to the one that we looked at first. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, it highlights the peculiarly human nature of evil, doesn't it? It highlights the human responsibility for evil in a way that the Bible also does. Although the fall, however you take that, and the evil that flows from it, is not the only example of evil in the Bible, it is the paradigm example of evil in the Bible. The death of animals or plants may be an evil in a sense, but generally when we describe it, we mean suffering or pain or unjustified reality caused by human agents. And so it has a certain ring of truth to it, doesn't it? Those are its strengths. But it also has significant weaknesses. And one of the most obvious is what it does to that second premise, which although ostensibly upholding, secretly undermines. Because if human beings are radically free, free in a contra-causal sense, free to choose A or B in a way that's unforeseeable by anyone, then it means they're free to choose in a way that's unforeseeable even to God. And if God is unable to foresee the actions of agents, then that limits his sovereignty. And yet the Bible says that God is in fact in total control of his creation. In a New Testament letter written in the first century, one writer, a follower of Jesus, Paul, can describe God's action in the world in this way. In him, and he's referring to in Jesus, we were also chosen, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. The picture of God in the Bible, and this is simply a sample, is overwhelmingly of a God who is totally in control of everything. Now, of course, at this point, we could jump down a rabbit hole and not get out of here until Tuesday. And that is, of course, of the relationship between divine responsibility and human responsibility. Can an agent have their actions determined and still be free, genuinely so? Well, I'm afraid for the purposes of this presentation, we'll just have to assume that, yes, they can. That God's sovereign control over activity does not in any way impugn human responsibility for our actions. But I'd understand how just the mere statement of that is not necessarily a satisfying resolution. It's simply another question, another seminar, perhaps another year. But more subtly than this, the problem with this attempt to resolve the problem of evil is that it makes human freedom the ultimate good, the thing for which God will go to any lengths to preserve in order to make his universe worthwhile. God will take any risk to preserve human autonomous freedom so they can make a free response to or for him. But do you see the subtle problem that emerges there? Freedom now becomes the God to whom God must answer. God is in some way bound by the necessity to make free beings, which surely means that God is in fact ungodded. But that in itself leads to an even more subtle trap. You see, because freedom is in fact necessary to the created order, necessary to make free rational moral agents, and evil is a necessary result of real freedom, evil also becomes necessary to the creation. Faced with that problem, the idea that evil in some ways actually has to be a part of this world in order for us to be free and hence moral, proponents of this argument will say, well, in the end, the evil was worth it in order to preserve that freedom. But again, you'll see we've just fallen into exactly the same trap as the first option, that of universal order. We're giving evil a place in the world and hence, to some extent, excusing it. So finally, let's move on, or not quite finally, penultimately, let's move on much more briefly to a third proposed solution before trying to unravel some of these knots and come up with something even approaching a satisfying answer. The third proposed solution is that by dialectical reasoning. I won't go into it in depth here simply because it's fiendishly complicated. I certainly don't pretend to understand it myself. It resides largely in the writings of Hegel, an 18th century German philosopher who very few people understand, including one suspects at times Hegel himself. But it's also a good deal more foreign to our own experience. Simply to say, this strategy, rather than attacking the first premise, what it means for evil to exist, or the second premise, what it means for God to be all-powerful, really addresses the concept of what it means for God to be all good. This strategy freely concedes that evil really does exist, and that even that God is in control of it, that he causes it in some sense, but that its existence is justified by the fact that God will bring some greater good from that evil. And he brings that goodness through from what Hegel described as the dialectic, the eternal dance of forces opposing one another, crashing into one another in a synthesis, which will then create some new thing. In this view, negativity is in fact absolutely necessary for our world to make progress. Hegel applied it to the concept of history, that it's only through the thesis and antithesis of evil and good that history makes its progress towards an idea of eternal spirit. More practically, Karl Marx applied this to the world of economics, saying that in the dialectic we saw the explanation for all of economic history, that only through the clash of the downtrodden and the bourgeoisie would eventually come the synthesis of the socialist state, the ultimate good. Now, of course, that does have, like all of these things, some strengths. It recognises the both biblically attested to fact, but also a fact attested to by normal experience, that sometimes good really does spring from evil. We've all had experiences where we've suffered things in the past which at the time felt very much to be evil and suffering, and yet which, with the benefit of hindsight, we'd never replace. Good really did come from evil. But the ultimate weakness is, in my view, a fatal one, because ultimately it makes God responsible for evil. The Bible does say that God can use evil once he finds it, so to speak, for his own good purposes. But that is a far cry from saying that God ordains evil so he may bring about his good purposes. If he were to do so, I think that would raise extremely serious, in fact fatally serious questions about his very goodness. The Bible repudiates that in the strongest terms. So, where exactly are we left with these three proposed solutions? The Bible affirms uncategorically all three premises of the problem of evil. the evilness of evil, the all-powerfulness of God, and the all-goodness of God. And all of the above strategies, in one way or another, actually end up undermining one or more of those premises. What are we to do? Are we left only with Habakkuk's cry of confusion? Is there actually an explanation for the origin of evil, and hence a solution to the problem of evil? Well, I think the answer is, in a word, no. Which may make you think this is a thoroughly disappointing seminar to come to. The weather has only just cleared up. You might have been able to have quite a nice lunch, possibly in a very nice restaurant with ice cream and bacon kept separate. No, there isn't. Now, that might seem like an almighty cop-out. Surely this is just saying, well, because we can't think of an answer right now, that there can't possibly be an answer. Surely this is just a descent into mystery, something which Christians seem to be all too prone to do. Oh, I don't understand it. Well, it's just a mystery, and so I'll throw up my hands in despair. And you'd be absolutely right with just about any other question you could raise. If we really do believe the world is orderly and we're a part of that orderly universe, our reasoning faculties should be able to work out answers to things, to move beyond mystery to some degree of certainty. It's precisely that, and it's precisely that conviction that keeps us investigating questions like this, and in fact questions of science. But the problem of evil is the one exception to this rule, precisely because of the nature of evil. And this really is the key point, I think, to understanding it. You see, evil is, by its own definition, inexplicable, because it is, by its very nature, absurd, disorderly, not part of the creation. If our human minds are designed to ascertain the way an orderly world fits together, they'll be very good at working out what those orders are. But if evil is by definition the disorder of that world, it will be impossible for our minds to ever get purchase on that. Human reason is designed to trace the connections in God's created order. But evil is the one thing that the Bible consistently says is not and never can be part of that order. In fact, if we were actually able to explain evil, we'd end up giving it a place in that order, wouldn't we? And that would make evil less than evil. Now, that may seem like a relatively anticlimactic and somewhat weak answer to the problem of the origin and, in fact, the deeper problem of evil that that raises. But I'd want to say that it's not as weak as the atheist response to evil. Because the atheist response can't even find a framework with which to adequately explain the existence of evil. That's not to say that atheists or non-Christians or non-theists don't recognise evil when they see it, don't feel evil as deeply as the rest of us. No, not at all. But without some overarching framework with which to explain what makes suffering evil, a metaphysical concept, the Christian is, in fact, even in the ability to explain it as disorder, in a better position. You see, evil, in the end, isn't there to be explained precisely because it is parasitic, it is disorderly. And that actually explains God's final answer in the book of Habakkuk, which we started this presentation with. Habakkuk, faced with these three impenetrable propositions which rammed up against him in his lived experience, was told in the end not to explain evil, but to trust God through it, to live by faith, trusting that he couldn't know everything. But living by faith doesn't mean that we are to capitulate to evil. Evil is not to be explained, but it is, in the biblical picture, to be fought. And the Christian tradition founds its very crux, and I use that word deliberately, on exactly where that fight was ultimately fought. The three premises of the problem of evil: its existence, God's all-consuming power and his all-consuming goodness, meet perfectly in, quite literally, the crux, the cross of Jesus of Nazareth. It's on the cross that we see the sheer evilness of evil. Here is humanity destroying God. Here is the ultimately disordered act. It is on the cross that we see ultimately the sovereignty of God. That the cross, although from our perspective a deep and heinous evil, was ultimately ordained by God himself to reconcile the world to himself. The cross demonstrates the goodness of God. One cannot look on the cross and think that God was ever content to compromise himself with evil, to sweep the problem of human evil under the carpet. No, it's in the cross, the Bible says, that evil is finally dealt with, but God's goodness in relation to his justice and his love is satisfied and fulfilled. Evil required him to bring about the death of his only son, and yet he did it because he is all good. The Bible doesn't explain the origin of evil. It can't. It is, in fact, the one phenomenon that by definition refuses explanation. But it does provide us with a better solution. It doesn't tell us about its origin, but it does tell us about its destination, that it will one day be destroyed, that the cross of Jesus Christ is in some way central to that destruction. And it's to that that the prophet Habakkuk was told to put his faith in, and in the language of the New Testament, what we're to put our faith in as well. Thank you very much.